This is an extraordinary occasion. There's no field in which superlatives are more cheaply used than in film criticism and discussion. Still, in the history of film, there are a few names that stand out as artists of purity and stature. One of those very few, and there could be no disagreement about this, is the Danish director, Carl Theodor Dreyer, born in 1889, whose directing career began in 1918, and whose works include The Passion of Joan of Arc, Day of Wrath, Odette, and his most recent film, Gertrude. To put it quite inadequately, I'm delighted that Mr. Dreyer has honored us with a visit. A very warm welcome to you, Mr. Dreyer. I know that you live very much in the present, so let's begin with your latest film, if we may, your film Gertrude, which was seen at the Third New York Film Festival. Will you tell us what led you to this work? What interested you in the theme?
It interested me in this sex-ridden time we live to talk about love and the different kinds of love, but still love. And I found it in the play by the Swedish author Hjalmar Söderberg. And the play Gertrude is built on his own love story to a young woman from the south of Sweden who came to Stockholm attracted by the literary world, just living in Stockholm at that time. It was a period of Strindberg and Ibsen and all the Scandinavian great names of that time, and also the painters, Zorn and the others, Larsson and the others. And I have tried to make it not only a picture about the story between Söderberg and that girl who came and asked him to help her to be a poetess, but also of the whole life in Stockholm at that time.
But isn't it true that, I think it's true, that the theme of the place of woman and the place of love in woman's life has run a lot through your films, through your life, hasn't it? Hasn't that concerned you?
I do not know. I think it is not on purpose, but I have always been attracted of people's sufferings and in particular of women's sufferings.
Yes, well,
Joan of Arc and...
We will certainly speak about her. As far as Gertrude is concerned, you mentioned painters, and this reminds me. The quality of light that you use in Gertrude, and of course your films are famous for the different qualities of light that you use in the different films, the quality in Gertrude seems less obviously dramatic than, for example, that in Day of Wrath. Did you visualize this change of tone before you started the film?
Oh, it comes all by itself. It is a part of the style in the film. And when we have worked 2 or 3 days in the film, we already know what kind of light we will have and what kind of style we wish.
In other words, in a sense, the style comes out of your experience of making.
Out of our daily work.
Yes. Now, if we may, I'd like to go back to the very beginning of your film life and learn from you how you became interested in films to begin with, because this was about the time of the First War, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. It was before the First War. The First War was 1915 to 18, and it was already in 1911-12. I was a young journalist, and I discovered it was a new material for a young journalist to write about films.
Yes.
And then gradually I approached the film people, and one day I was asked to make a script for a film. And I made it, and I made one more and one more. And then I was asked to There were several companies in that period, but the biggest one was...
This is all in Copenhagen.
In Copenhagen.
Yes.
It was a Great Northern Film Company, yeah. And was asked to enter the dramaturgish department,
yes.
Where scenarios were found and studied, and scripts were made, and...
What we would call the story department.
The story department, yeah. But dramaturgish, yeah. Sounds... Fine.
More grand.
Yes. Yes. So I was, I became acquainted with the script writing and filmatizing of novels and all that. And later on, I had to do with the cutting of the films, the editing, you call it.
Yes.
At that time, the film directors only worked in summertime 3-4 months, and in that time they make in general 10 to 12 or 15 films.
Because they needed sunlight.
Yes, yeah. And they had not the time to cut their films themselves, and so there was a special department for that, and I was a member of that department, and later on the head of that department. And I learned a terrible lot of things about during this work with the cuttings, because the directors sent their films as soon as they have finished the last shot in the studio. They sent the whole material out to the cutting department
and put it all in your hands.
Put it all in my hands, and I learned very, very much by this work.
By having to assemble the material.
Yes.
And your first film was The President, that you directed yourself.
Then I was asked to if I would like to make a film myself, and I accepted, and I chose The President by the Austrian author Karl Emil Franzos. Mm. And it was a little melodramatic story, but it gave me an opportunity to work with flashbacks, which was a very new thing at that time.
The contemporary criticisms of that picture note that from the very beginning of your career, that not only this matter of flashbacks and intercutting,
no.
But that the film had a sense of decor as yes. Contributory to character.
Yes, I put a great weight on the good building of settings. So, because I maintained that any room, any inhabited room, bears the stamp of the man or the woman who lives in that room. And therefore, it was very useful for the understanding of the personalities to see how their rooms were. And I was in that question was influenced by the Danish painter Hammerich,
whose work I don't know.
And by the English painter Whistler.
Well,
yes,
his I do know a little. Very soon after that, you made a much grander film, much more ambitious film called Leaves from Satan's Notebook.
Yes. The young directors from the Great Northern, there were 10 or 12 or more directors at that time, and the young directors were one day invited to see the last arrived American film by Griffith, Intolerance.
Intolerance. Mm-hmm.
And it made a terrible impression.
On you mean a large impression? Tremendous.
Enormous, yes. Tremendous, yes. We saw the film until in the middle of the night, and I went alone home, and I saw so many new possibilities for the film which I had never seen before. And I made, by chance, I was offered to make a script by a Danish author in cooperation with the author Corelli.
Marie Corelli.
Maria Corelli, yes. Yes. And it was also in 4
episodes
like Griffith film,
yes.
But only in 4 separated episodes.
Yes.
And in the last of them, I was certainly, I know it, and I confess it directly, influenced by Griffith's modern story of intolerance.
You have said, I think, that there are only two directors whose influence you are conscious of, and he is one. And
the Sistrom, really. And he learned me something about milieu and about the rhythm of an epoch, because up to now they were made in this rapid rhythm.
Yes.
Which, the aim of which apparently was to make people forget what they have seen. then I saw one film, The Sons of Ingmar by Sistrom, and I saw suddenly that his farmer people, his patients, they entered the room with heavy steps and slow motions and took place around an enormous table. And I saw that was the real rhythm of farmer people.
Yes.
Farmer people do not hop and jump.
Like movie actors.
Yes, like movie actors. But they acted really like farmers.
Yes. And you got, may I say, from Sjöström, a sense of the rhythm of character motion
in
film.
Yes, yeah. That is.
In the 20s, you spent a good deal of time in Berlin, didn't you?
Yes, I went to Berlin to make a Danish author, Madelung was his name. He had been in Russia for many years and had written a book, Liebet euch, or something like
love
that.
Love each other.
Yes, love each other, yes. Yeah. It was in Fight Russia during the time of the pogroms in 1905.
Oh, this is your film on Russian anti-Semitism.
Kind of Russian anti-Semitism. And I was attracted by the strange milieu and the action too. Mm. And the cruelty of the Russian.
And
I made a film. The Danish Film Museum has just got a copy of the film. It was very difficult to find.
And they had to get one from Russia?
Yes. Mm. And very complete.
Let's move on now, if we may, to the subject that so many Americans associate with your name. First, that of Joan. That had been in your mind for some time, the theme of Joan of Arc, hadn't it?
I'll tell you the truth exactly. I was negotiating with the French company, Société Générale de Film, and I was asked what I would like to make. I said, I do not know. I should like to make Marie Antoinette. I should like to make the Queen, the Catherine de Medici.
Catherine de Medici?
Medici, or Joan of Arc. And then I was asked, which one of them? You can only make one. And then I chose Joan of Arc.
The method of Joan of Arc, which is now world famous among cinema specialists at least, and among many audiences, was that in your mind from the beginning, or as with Gertrude, did it evolve as you made the film?
No, the style was not entirely, but we worked with the costumes and we worked with the settings. I had a German architect beside the French architect Jean Hugo, and little by little came the style, and then I made the script, and the script was based on the trial of Joan of Arc, and was directly based on the protocol. Yeah. Of which two copies exist in France, one in Paris and another one in Rouen, I think. And this protocol does only consist of questions and answers. And therefore, to each question there was a close-up of the man who made the question, and a close-up of the poor little Jeanne d'Arc who answered the question. And therefore, it came quite naturally that the most of the film was a simple
back and forth, yes, confrontation.
Yes.
So one could say that the actual record of the trial,
yes,
dictated the, yes, style, yeah, of the film
the
to
style.
You through
That's
you, through your
what
eyes.
I would like to say, yes.
Yes. Falconetti, who plays Joan in the film,
yes,
had she been an actress, or had you seen her?
Oh,
or,
sure. I had looked for the right actress for Joan of Arc, I think during months, and I have not been made. I have seen tens and tens and tens of young actresses, all of them believed they were the right Jeanne d'Arc. But I hesitated still and still. And one day I was asked to go to a little boulevard theater and see her in a vaudeville, very light thing. And in a certain way I was attracted, though I didn't think she would be the right one. But I was invited to have a cup of tea with her next day in her apartment, Avenue de Champs-Élysées, and I went there. And we sat and talked together about Joan of Arc and other things, and I felt there was something in that woman, something deep in her, very interesting. And I'd asked her to come the next morning without makeup. I just came with her naked face, and I would take a shot of her. And she came with makeup, but she took it off, and that she did during the whole film. She came in the morning with the makeup and took her makeup off.
She was an actress who got
face.
Unmade,
yes,
up at,
yes,
the studio.
Yes. And we took a picture of her naked face, and I felt it was very interesting. She had figuratively spoken some scars of the time of suffering or something, I didn't know what, but there was something very beautiful in the face, and I managed that we got her, or my company managed.
And the rest is quite literally history.
Yes.
A curious thing about that film in this country is that it arrived in 1929 here, when sound films had already become a vogue.
Oh, yes.
And a headline of one of the reviews in this country was, "A dying art offers a masterpiece," the silent film being,
yes,
the dying art. But your next film...
The well-known French critic, André Lévison,
yes,
he said in his review, this is the last silent film and the first talkie.
Well,
because the film was built up on dialogue,
yes,
all the time.
Yes, yes. Even though silent,
yes,
it existed,
yes,
through the,
yes,
questions and answers. But your next film, Vampire, which you made, I think, 3 or 4 years later,
oh,
had,
yes,
very little dialogue in it. Were you consciously resisting sound, like Chaplin, or...?
No. But a film with sound was, at that time, much more expensive than a silent film. Just as today, a film in colors is much more expensive than a white and black film. Mm. And so it was a question of how we could make a talkie without talking, and without a soundtrack. And we made it in that way that I found a group of actors from Germany, from France, from Denmark even, and we made it in three versions. These actors all spoke English, French and German so well that their lip movements were correct.
Mm-hmm.
So later on, it was no difficulty to put foreign foreign voices upon the picture, upon,
yes,
the stage. So we had three versions: an English version, a French version, and.
So it was really done essentially for a technical reason, not an artistic one.
Yes, and then the dialogue was very slow. And then there was a lot of other sounds. Barking dogs, yes. And many other things. Weeping children.
But you kept the dialogue sparse, so that you could do this dubbing.
Yes.
I'd like to raise now what may have to be our last major subject, which is your film Days of Wrath.
Yes.
Which you made in 1943 in German-occupied Denmark.
Yes.
Was there in your mind when you made this film of fight against oppression some kind of analogy with the condition of your country at the time?
It was insinuated that the film was a secret attack on the Germans. I'm sorry to say it wasn't. I didn't think of that. I just made a filmatization of a Norwegian play. Mm. And I have not the intention to change the film in order to attack the Germans. They suffered sufficiently in Denmark because of the underground movement.
Yes.
And it was, I would have found it very artificial to use a film for that.
In other words, you didn't want to twist the play that interested you in order to make it topical.
I had only the artistic purpose to make a good film.
Yes. But then your next film that we know in this country well is Ordet, by Kai Munk, the priest playwright who was killed by the Nazis. How did you come to that?
I happened to be present at the first performance of the play, and I was so enthusiastic about it as a film object that I asked Kai Munk if I could get an option of the right. He answered back, "Yes, just put $250,000 check in your letter, your next letter." He was so. I couldn't put in it, but I nevertheless, a couple of years later, after his death, I had the possibility to make the film.
And you made it in Munk's native village?
Yes,
where he
was a pastor. Mm. And where he had been a pastor, I made the location scenes. Yes, he died in the meantime. He was a very courageous man who spoke against the Germans, and was warned several times by the Germans. But he continued, and one day a German car came with four German officers and took him at his house before the eyes of his wife.
I have time to ask you just one more thing, and it's something that must go on the record. One of the great apocryphal mysteries and legends of our time is the film about Jesus that you have been planning for some years. Do you still plan to go ahead with it?
Yes, I hope I can make it someday, but I cannot hope to make it without money. That is.
You have the script all written.
I have the script. It is made, and I think it is. I have succeeded in making a good script, and that is nevertheless the base of a good film.
Good. Well, in other words, there's a substantial portion of your career ahead of you.
Yes.
We all hope.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've had the privilege of spending a half hour in the company of Carl Theodor Dreyer, acknowledged by the world to be one of the preeminent artists in the history of film. Thanks are perhaps impertinent, but we dare to thank you, Mr. Dreyer, and to give you every good wish.